Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close is real life in the Middle East to the turbulent street scenes that dominate print headlines and TV newscasts in the American media? My guest today is an American who has spent much of his life in the Middle East, starting as a little boy living in a sheltered American enclave of Libya when Muammar Gaddafi seized power in 1969. Neil McFarquhar later studied Arabic and returned to the region as an adult journalist, eager to reconnect with the places that had shaped his childhood view of the world. While he did find some of the violence and oppression so familiar to U.S. news audiences, McFarquhar realized that those stories tend to blind the West to the other Middle East, a place filled with interesting, creative, and passionate people who are far more interested in social and political progress than we may realize. Neil McFarquhar is former Cairo bureau chief, now UN bureau chief for the New York Times. His new book is called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Neil, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for talking to me.
Whether intentional or not, it does seem that media coverage of the Middle East tends to suggest to Americans, first and foremost, that it is a place to fear. What do we miss out on when our vision begins with that emotion?
Well, I think that there, you know, I was kind of shocked into writing this book a little bit by a question from a dedicated New York Times reader. I was at a dinner party in San Francisco, and she said, you know, aren't there any normal people in the Middle East, you know, people like you and me, or at least people we could empathize with? And I sort of thought back over all the assignments I've had over the years, and I've been a reporter there. I started in 1988, and I thought, you know, I covered the first Gulf War, various Palestinian uprisings against the Israeli occupation, the 9/11 fallout, the invasion of Iraq, and there's just this litany of violent events. And so, of course, that tends to be our image of the region. But when I went back through and thought the people I spent time with, you know, and the people that I enjoyed writing about, it's like the most famous chef in the region, one of the most beloved divas who actually has played Vegas, a sex therapist, a veiled sex therapist, and there's all kinds of people. So I think that, you know, there's sort of stories. When there's a reporter, when you're a reporter, there's stories you have to write, and there's stories you want to write. And I think that this book pulls together a lot of the stories I wanted to write.
Yeah, let's talk about this Chef Ramsay. He is this guy who's generating a lot of interest in culture beyond the Middle East simply by introducing people to food from other places.
Well, he sort of talks about, you know, a lot of the book is about how people try and bring change to the region. And his point of view was that people tend to follow their traditional recipes too much, and so he tries to get them to look at the broader world and to mix sort of things like a Thanksgiving turkey into the Ramadan menu when Muslims break their fast at the end of the day during their holiest month. But it's a fantastic show because it's a cooking show, but he takes calls. And one time, like, a bee fell into his white sauce just before he was about to end the show, and he's got this big thing about cleanliness. And so the bee fell into the thing, and the cameraman focused right on it, so he had to do something. So he flipped it out, and he said, normally I'd start over, but I can't. There isn't enough time. And so the phones lit up because he takes calls. And a woman from Saudi Arabia said, you know, you always stress cleanliness. How can you do this to us? And then a woman from Sudan called, and she said, you know, bees are mentioned in the Quran, and it says they have a soul, and they're clean, so you should have just left it in there. And then a Syrian man called and said, you know, do we have to bring the Quran into everything? Can't we just cook? And, you know, sort of when you watch a show like that, you sort of feel like you're eavesdropping on an extended Arab living room, and you realize that it's not all about, you know, violence and fundamentalism.
Well, it is such an interesting example in that there's this tug of war going on, even on this cooking show, between embracing what is new and sort of obsessing over ancient rules and edicts.
I think that's true. And, you know, I think that there is a way to, I mean, there is a difficulty in sort of grappling with how they fit into the modern world and how they can and use some of their traditions. I think the other example of that I devote a whole chapter to in the book is about fatwas. And in the West, we kind of tend to know fatwas as a death sentence because the most famous one was the one Ayatollah Khomeini pronounced against Salman Rushdie for his book, The Satanic Verses. But people use fatwas for all kinds of things. You know, they ask their clerics about sex, they ask them about their businesses, they ask them about political life. So it's not all, you know, it's not all about religion. It's also sort of greases the wheels of daily life.
Yeah, I think that may have been the most interesting chapter for me in the entire book, because it goes from really minutiae, things that wouldn't seem to matter very much at all, to these big things. And people now are not above what you call fatwa shopping. They'll look around for someone who gives them the justification to do whatever it is they want to do anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it causes no amount of confusion because there's no central authority that issues them. So anybody with sort of a religious background can start issuing fatwas and say, that it's based on legitimate religious rule. I think my favorite one are probably the dog fatwas in Iran, because, you know, the Islamic Republic was founded on the idea that it was going to get rid of Western ways, and one thing the Quran frowns upon is dog ownership. Certain kinds of dogs, little dogs, guard dogs are okay. And so every once in a while, the mullahs look around and they decide there's too many dogs in the country, so they start issuing these fatwas saying that dog ownership is bad, and, you know, they never thought they'd see the day of the horror of watching men walk around carrying short-legged dogs. And then people, because they don't like the regime, they'll get dogs just to sort of stick it to them. And then there's become a black market for dogs because the supply is limited. And I walked through the animal market one day, and there was, like, dog dealers coming up and whispering in my ear, like, got a German Shepherd, I got a German Shepherd, you want a German Shepherd?
And people there certainly do love their dogs as much as anywhere else when they feel like it's permissible to have them.
It's true. I mean, you know, I think as a culture, I mean, even among Christians, there is a certain amount of, I mean, some people just don't like them because it is written in the holy text that they are unclean. But when people do adopt them and take care of them, yeah, they do love them just as much as anywhere else.
Another big surprise to me was that fatwas, even ones that are issued really from on high, are not absolutely inviolable. And if they're just so completely ridiculous, there is a possibility that popular pressure will change something.
Well, the fatwa shopping thing is when people don't like the ruling, they just go find another clerical, agree with them. And that's why a lot of people don't like them. And certainly sort of progressive Arabs are horrified by the idea that people go to their clerics to get them to decide on how to vote in political races or things like that. But every once in a while, they'll just, you know, the religious figure will do something so outlandish that it raises a popular outcry. A couple of years ago in Egypt, there was a woman, you know, a veiled woman, religious woman, who covered her hair with a headscarf. And she'd worked in the same office with a man for 20 years. So she asked the clerk, can I take my headscarf off around him because I know him so well, even though he's not a blood relative? And the clerk said, well, what you have to do is you have to allow him to suckle at your breast, and then it'll be like your adopted son, and then you can take your headscarf off. And obviously the idea of a grown man licking his colleague's breast was outrageous as a way to, you know, to enforce modesty. And, you know, there's a big outcry, and the cleric said, well, it wasn't really a fatwa, I was just expressing my opinion.
Something else that really surprised me was over and over it comes up that the people in the Middle East, even those living under really totalitarian regimes, are not entirely unaware that certain aspects of what they're living under are backward.
Yeah, and I think that is an important point, and that was why sort of the people from outside need to speak more to the general population and not to the governments. I mean, the example I love the most is Libya, where I grew up, and Colonel Gaddafi, who's run the place since 1969, keeps changing the date. Now, most Muslims date the calendar from when Muhammad made a pilgrimage from Medina to Mecca, and that's the one most Muslims around the world use. But Gaddafi keeps switching it around. Sometimes he decides it should be the year of Muhammad's birth. Sometimes he decides it should be his death. And when I was in Libya once, and the newspapers were dated 1429, the newspapers were dated 1429, but the government was using the year 1369, and, you know, you couldn't tell what was what, so everybody just put the Western date in parentheses. And I went to sort of a political neighborhood meeting that all Libyans are required to go to, and one woman just stood up and she said, why do we have to change the date every 2 years? Can't we just be normal? And I think that's a rallying cry for a lot of people in the region.
And Gaddafi's even tried to change the names of the months.
Yeah, he's a big hero. Hannibal, who walked across the Alps with elephants, is a big hero of his. So he changed, I think it was August, if I remember correctly, to Hannibal. And he changed some other month, February maybe, to lights. And he mucks around with the calendar quite a bit.
So how are these fatwas enforced if there's not really a central repository for them? I guess some of them are sort of part of the law, and others are just social custom.
It varies country by country. And I think that's another sort of error that happens. I don't know if I should call it an error, but a difficulty in looking at the region, and that we tend to sort of lump all the countries together, and they are very different. But obviously in Iran with its Islamic revolution, and also in Saudi Arabia, which also has sort of the strictest form of Islam prevalent, a rather Puritan form known as Wahhabism, there's a whole religious police force that go around and making sure that people's behavior coincides with Islamic tradition. So there's no formal mechanism, but there's kind of an informal one that is employed by some governments.
Neil McFarquhar is my guest. He's UN Bureau Chief of the New York Times. We're talking about his new book, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. We'll resume our conversation with Neil in a moment and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Right now, I am joined by Jeff Whittington, who is the senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Jeff, we are still working on our spring membership campaign. It appears we are absolutely in reach of getting this all sewn up today.
Yes, I believe we are, Chris. We have $73,400 left to raise. You can help with that at 800-456-5372 or via the web at kera.org. If you have thought about supporting KERA at a higher membership level during this drive, but you have not yet made that call, this would be a great time, a $1,000 contribution, a $2,000 contribution. You can see how that kind of contribution would really knock this total down. So please consider a gift at any level. But if you have been considering a higher level, this would be a wonderful time to call 800-456-5372 or go online to kera.org.
I think, you know, consider doing it now for all the people who have already made their contributions. They, you know, have given all they can already and won't, you know, give again necessarily. This is the time for you to step up and say, okay, I realize that everybody else who was going to give has done so. I'm going to now do my part. It's never been more important than it is right on this day. 1-800-456-5372 is our number. You can also go to kera.org. I want to thank Gabrielle Swain in Watauga and Linnea Castillo in Dallas, Zena Rooker in Southlake, and all of you who are getting on the line right now. We do have a $5,000 challenge grant if we can finish off our fundraising today. That's from Diane Wanger.
Yes, she's a Tarrant County family law attorney. If the drive ends today, Diane will give an additional $5,000 to the station. So you can see how important it is that we raise that $73,000 and change between now and 7 o'clock, because we really want to go out strong. We want to finish this drive and not be back here tomorrow morning asking you still to support the station. And, you know, I think that we talked a little bit on some of the breaks over the weekend and last week about how whether or not you feel like we're talking to you. Well, we are talking to you, especially if you have not supported KERA, but you listen all the time. Perhaps you've had that thought, gee, maybe I should contribute to the station. Well, we would love for you to do that right now at any level, any contribution level, $100, $500, whatever's right for you and for your budget would really help us finish this membership campaign here today and be able to accept an additional $5,000 from Diane Wanger. The number is 800-456-5372. The place online is kera.org.
We would love to be able to send you a copy of Neil McFarquhar's excellent book, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. That's available when you make a contribution at the $120 level or above. It is a really interesting look and a surprising look at the Middle East. In parts, it's funny. In parts, it's very poignant. A fascinating read if the region and the way it's progressing today is of interest to you. You can call us right now at 1-800-456-5372 and make that contribution and take that book as your thank you gift.
Yeah, the number to call is 800-456-KERA. Thanks to Jose Rinaldi, Jovet in Dallas, Doyle Little in Hurst, and Lucy McElroy in Richardson. Thanks so much for your support. Please be the next one to call 800-456-5372 or contribute online at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the UN Bureau Chief of the New York Times, former Cairo Bureau Chief Neil McFarquhar. His new book is called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. We have the book available with our compliments at the $120 membership level if you join us today at 1-800-456-5372. You can also do this at KERA.org. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Chris in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am an atheist, a devout atheist, and I'm taking issue with the use of calling certain practices in Islam backwards. And I just wish you guys would not use that when you're referring. A couple times you said it, and I found it a little bit, like you're using it incorrectly, I feel.
Well, I appreciate you making the call, and I probably could have been more artful in the way I described that. I was talking about things like Gaddafi renaming the year and things like that. But Neil, I know this is something that you're sensitive to, and you're certainly not condemning Islam as a faith.
Oh, not at all. No, and I think that, you know, I think that the people that use it towards violent ends have kind of hijacked it, and I think there are a lot of people in the region that object to that, and then they've ended up being you know, the main victims of that.
I want to talk a little bit about having grown up in Libya, because it seems like a really fascinating experience. You were living there, but among Americans who did everything in their power at the time to feel like they were not living in Libya.
Well, I always, you call it Texas on the Mediterranean, actually, just because I grew up with so many Texas. But, you know, it was an oil town, and it was founded in 1965 to ship crude oil that was bubbling up in the desert out to, you know, the United States and Europe. And so all the engineers and everybody involved was American. And at one point it was run by Esso, which is the precursor to Exxon. They just decided that the Libyans would not be allowed to live in the town. So they put a fence around the area. We were sort of bordered on the Mediterranean on one side and the Sahara Desert on the other. And all Libyans had to be outside the fence by 5 o'clock at the end of the working day. For a kid, you know, I mean, we ran to the beach every afternoon and sailed and swam. It was kind of idyllic. But that chain-link fence really kind of separated us from the country. And I think the biggest mark of that is that, you know, when Gaddafi took over in a coup on September 1st, 1969, I was sitting at the breakfast table with my father, and he flipped on the BBC News, as he did every morning. And the first headline was, you know, there's been a coup in Libya. And we just kind of stared at the radio dumbfounded, like, really? But there had been no indication at all in the town because we were sort of divorced from the country around us.
One huge blow to your parents and their friends was when Gaddafi came into power and then banned alcohol. So all of a sudden you have these highly paid executives making what amounts to moonshine in their laundry rooms.
Yeah, the laundry rooms, they were built so that they could put a maid could live in there. So there was a bathroom and everything. But, of course, there were no maids because Libyans weren't allowed to live in the town. So everybody put them immediately to good use to making liquor, and you know, it became this competition because most of them were chemical engineers about who could make the best. And, you know, sometimes the experiments went a little bit bad. Like my father made ginger beer one year, and he put too much in the bottles, and they were all stacked up on our kitchen counter, and they started to explode. So it would shatter glass around the kitchen. So we'd have to take a garbage can lid and sort of yell, cover me, and run and get some butter or orange juice from the refrigerator and run back out of the kitchen until all the bottles had erupted.
So you are fluent today in Arabic, but none of this happened when you were a kid there living in Libya.
No, and, you know, regrettably. The oil company, every year they sent a sort of promising young engineering trainee to improve his English so he could go study abroad. And, of course, all us kids knew each other because we went through year by year. And so when he'd say, did you learn the alphabet last year? We would have already decided among ourselves to fool him, and we'd say, no, we didn't learn the alphabet. And then he'd teach it to us again, and we'd all get really good grades. But it's fine. You know, I did go back and learn the language, and I try and put some of my favorite expressions in the book. You know, some of them show certain aspects of the culture. Like one of them is called, words in the book that I describe as tabarruj, which is to display your charms. And it's something that the religious police yell at women if they think that, you know, she's showing too much flesh or she's talking to men who are not related to. This is in Saudi Arabia, mind you. And they'll yell, Yamutabarraja, which is sort of, stop being such a brazen hussy.
You write about something, a very interesting experience, which is having been in the Middle East for several years, covering things there, and then you got on a plane, and I guess there was a, I don't know, a KLM flight attendant or something who had this very short skirt on. And you were, on the one hand, struck by it and sort of attracted to it, and then despite having been raised as an American, you were a little bit shocked by it.
Well, I think you do kind of, as when you take on, you know, you kind of take on the culture of the people around you when you spend a long time there. And the other example of that that was kind of striking to me was I was at a conference of Egyptian lawyers, and the lawyers are heavily, you know, there's a lot of Muslim brothers, very conservative religious men in the Muslim Brotherhood, and they were having their convention at a beachside hotel, and half the hotel was, you know, heavily bearded lawyers in suits, and the other half was half-naked Italian and Russian tourists, you know, sunbathing by the pool. And I just took in that scene, and I had just been in Egypt for so many years that I could kind of see it the way, you know, that the lawyers were seeing it, which was sort of, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah.
We hear so much about the power of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think you write some really interesting things about the fact that it is not an entirely cohesive body, that there is occasionally some sort of internal conflict there.
Yeah, I think we've seen that in recent years in terms of a young generation coming in and, you know, opening blogs to talk about what they think about the Muslim Brotherhood, and the sort of older generation is, you know, in their 80s, and they say, you know, we don't want the laundry washed in public. You can't talk about things like that, and you shouldn't be talking about movies because you shouldn't be going to movies. And so I think there is some generational tension there. And I think the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, it sort of reached its apex of power in the 1940s and 1950s, and then it was violently suppressed. And that kind of left a mark on the older generation. And it's one of the reasons that sort of analysts there that I agree with think that the Muslim Brotherhood will never really lead change, you know, because they don't like to stick their necks out.
How powerful are technologies like blogging and cell phones and things like that in giving people a perspective on the world outside the Middle East?
I think it's growing. It took a little while to take off, but it's hugely more popular, especially in countries like Iran, where they are incredibly technologically sophisticated and they play constant cat and mouse games with the censors that try and block anything that's sort of political or what they would consider immoral. And in Egypt, you've seen things like, you know, a year ago they organized an entire national strike just by using Facebook. But then again, they tried to do it again this year to repeat it on the anniversary, and it didn't work. So I think that it is an organizing tool, especially because, you know, people, all these countries have incredibly repressive laws where you're not allowed to, you know, you don't have the right to assembly and the right to free speech is curbed. But it's hard for the government to control that on the web. But that being said, you know, I don't think that they're going to foment a revolution via Twitter.
Do you think, Neil, that exposure works both ways? You know, we talk often about how great it is that people living in repressive societies are having access to ideas beyond their borders. I wonder if you think that Westerners who really need to understand the culture in places like the Middle East are making as much effort to see what else is out there from the perspective of people within the Middle East.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I mean, part of it is you know, there's a language barrier, obviously, and so a lot of what is written is not always accessible. But I think I certainly, just in living there, you know, I tried to just see things like movies and meet artists and things like that. And they, you know, that I think you, when you try and sort of get beyond just the daily news, you meet all kinds of interesting people. In any society.
Can you tell us a little bit about Fairuz?
Fairuz is sort of the most famous, at the moment, probably, Arab singer. She's Lebanese. She's a Greek Orthodox woman who was discovered in the 1950s by a man looking for a national chorus for Lebanon. And she kind of represents, for me, kind of an interesting time, because she sings Arab poetry, but in a, you know, sort of Western manner, much shorter songs, and sort of using Western instruments. And she's hugely popular, and I think for two reasons. One is she kind of talks about traditional life and village life and, you know, the vineyards and things like that. And also she embodies that mix of the meeting of East and West. And so she, you know, has this enormous following across the region.
Does her act tend to change from country to country?
Say again, I didn't hear you.
Does her act change? Maybe her lineup of songs change?
No, I think, you know, they love, you know, her song. And I saw her twice. I saw her once in Egypt underneath the Sphinx in 1989, and then again in Vegas. And I write about both concerts in the book. And the fascinating thing was in Egypt was that, you know, she had boycotted Egypt because it signed a peace treaty with Israel for 10 years, and it was her first concert there. But then by that time, the border was open because there was a peace treaty. So Palestinians, Israeli Arabs, you know, Palestinians with Israeli nationality could come over the border. And thousands of them came to see her, and they were just like weeping. And you know, because here was this sort of idol, this woman that had been singing about Palestinian villages and stuff. And, of course, the funny thing on that was when the Egyptian government saw all these people coming in, they jacked up the tax bill. And so the promoters just printed a bunch of new tickets to pay the bill and sold them, and there wasn't enough room in the amphitheater for people, so it was kind of pandemonium for a few hours while everyone got seated.
And ultimately, she didn't actually take the stage until like 2 in the morning or something.
Yeah, the concert in there, but it started at 11, and, you know, so all these people who paid like $100 for a ticket were showing up, you know, in their limousines at 11. They kept coming and kept coming and kept coming, and, you know, at one point, like about 1 o'clock in the morning after 2 hours of this, and they'd filled up every available space with seats, and people were still coming. And he came out on the stage and he said, "We've discovered the problem. There's a Zionist plot to ruin our concert," you know, which is this canard that they use for everything, including bad weather. And then finally she came on at about 2 and she sang for a couple hours, and it was, you know, a tremendous success. Everybody forgot all about the pandemonium.
Neil McFarquhar is my guest. He is UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times. His new book is called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. We would love to be able to offer you a copy of the book with our compliments when you join at the $120 level or above. Of course, please consider the above if you are thinking about making a contribution to KERA today. We are hoping that we will be able to finish our fundraising today. We can do it if you will call right now, 1-800-456-5372. You can also go online to kera.org. We will resume our conversation, of course, with Neil McFarquhar in just a few minutes, but we want to give you this opportunity, while it's not a fascinating discussion, while it's just Jeff Whittington and me talking to you about fundraising, now's the perfect time to go online and click that support button or make that call at 1-800-456-5372. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Online at kera.org. You can do your part to help end this membership campaign. Perhaps today, we started this morning, Chris, needing about 95,000 or somewhere in there to finish the drive today. And we're down into the low 70,000s left to raise. And that means that your call right now to 800-456-KERA or your online contribution at KERA.org can get us that much closer to finishing. There are so many of you who have supported the station during this drive, and I want to thank each and every one of you very, very much for your participation. After all, that is our ultimate goal. It's just your participation at whatever level is appropriate for you. You get to decide that, but please decide to support the station financially today, because we can wrap this drive up if we hear from you.
If you believe that public radio is important, and if you believe specifically that it's important that you have a public radio station in your community, supporting KERA makes perfect sense. You can decide how much you want to spend supporting the station. Maybe you're at a place in your life where you can become a friend of the station, and that's members who give an annual contribution of $1,500 or more. If you set up a sustaining membership plan, it comes out of your checking account once a month as a $125 contribution, which for some of you is impossible, and for many of you may in fact be quite affordable and allow you to sort of base your charitable giving on KERA. We would appreciate your contribution at any level at 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org.
If you'd like your very own copy of Neil's book, you can receive that when you join at the $120 membership level. The book is out this week. Of course, it's available at your local retailer or your favorite online bookseller for a much more reasonable price than $120. We're not selling you Neil's book for $120. We're actually thanking you when you join at that membership level with your very own copy of the book. So if you're interested in the book and you want to support KERA at the same time, this is a great opportunity. Just call 800-456-5372 or go online to kera.org and join at the $120 membership level.
We know that a great deal of you choose not to take a thank you gift, and that's fine too. We will just take your entire contribution, and instead of purchasing the book and sending it to you as our thank you, we will just put all of your money to work paying for the programming that you like on the station. But the choice is up to you. If it's something that would sort of sweeten the deal for you, we would love to do it. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. I think maybe my favorite membership level in terms of cool benefits is the day sponsor membership. That's $365 a year. Essentially, you give a dollar a day, and you get three different recorded messages to be played on the air on KERA throughout the day, on the day of your choosing, as long as it's not taken already. Any non-commercial message will do. If you want to congratulate somebody or tell someone you love them or say whatever you want to say, this is what we're able to offer you. And it can be a lot of fun. You may have heard some of them throughout the months and years here on KERA.
Yeah, it's available. And there are 365 days available that you can choose from on the day sponsorship. So I'm sure that a lot of those dates are still open. So call 800-456-5372. You have to call, and I believe, and use your credit card to take advantage of that, Chris. We want to say thanks to Marla Savant in Dallas, Sandy Ferguson-Taylor in Denton, and Paul Sampson in Terrell. We heard from them. How about you? Call us, 800-456-5372.
The way we set up our fundraising now is that instead of having four drives a year, we have three. We know that you appreciate that. And even when they sort of extend over a couple of weeks, we are still spending fewer hours fundraising, fewer days fundraising overall, because you've responded, because you've told us this is the way we want to do it. But we can't stop fundraising until we have the money that we're going to need to make sure that we can deliver the programming that you count on every single day of the year. That's why we do it this way. You can help us out by calling 1-800-456-5372. If, thanks to you and your support, we can raise all the money we need by the end of today, Diane Wanger, a Tarrant County family law attorney, will give the station an additional $5,000. That's big money for us. Your contribution can make it possible.
Yeah, the drive has to end today in order to achieve this challenge. So with your call right now at 800-456-5372, your online pledge at kera.org right now will help us meet that challenge. KERA will be able to accept an additional $5,000. So please don't wait. Please do your part right now.
You know, membership in KERA is voluntary. We can't force you to give money in order to continue listening to the station. But if it's a service that you use every day, and if you believe that charitable giving is something that's important, we would ask that you work KERA in, because we're a community organization that serves you and your family as well as the rest of the community. Please call now, 1-800-456-5372, or make a contribution online at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. New York Times UN Bureau Chief Neil McFarquhar is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new book, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. If you'd like to join our conversation, we welcome you to call 1-800-933-5372. Neil, I'm remiss in getting this far into the interview without asking you to talk about the title of your book. You get birthday emails from Hezbollah.
Well, when you work in any Hezbollah-controlled territory, which is basically the southern neighborhoods of Beirut or South Lebanon, you have to fill out a bunch of forms before they'll sort of let you wander around. And they ask you where you went to college, what your degrees are, they ask you what your mother's name is, and they ask you your birth date. And so, you know, I just filled that out, and so it came as a surprise to me that they started sending me every year in Hezbollah. It's Hezbollah with an I at Hezbollah.org would send me an email, a birthday email.
When you went to Libya as a journalist in 2001, you write that you never felt personally threatened or resented at all, because the assumption of the people there was that Americans are every bit as much pawns of their own government as they feel like they may be of theirs.
I think that that's true. I mean, not just in Libya, but across the region. I think, you know, people often ask me, like, well, how did they react to you as American? Because they know that there's a certain amount of hostility towards Americans. And I, you know, I'm 6 foot 3 and a bit, and I have blonde hair, so I don't blend in at all. I kind of look like everyone's, you know, idea of what an American is supposed to look like over there. And the only year that I faced overt hostility was in 2003. That was the year of the invasion, and there were just, like, every night people saw pictures of American soldiers rolling through Iraq. And that was the year that, you know, people would throw things at me in the street, or they would just kind of cut off conversations. You know, and sometimes it sort of was darkly comic. One time I was in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, and I broke a tooth, and so I had to go to the clinic first thing in the morning to a dentist I didn't know. And he, you know, I was asking him where he got his education and where he'd studied dentistry. Anyway, he was a Syrian, and so he's fiddling with his tools and his implements, and finally he turns to me, and he's got the drill in his hand. He said, "Why, where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm from New York." And he said, "American. That's not a very popular thing to be. Open wide." And he started the drill, but he did a fine job. And I think that year, 2003, I mean, I'm certainly nowhere in the Middle East did I ever face the kind of hostility that reporters in Iraq did and the violence there, but that was the one year that I felt it.
Was it hard not to take it personally?
You know, I didn't take it personally because, you know, it's demoralizing because obviously you're trying to tell people's story as a reporter and present a complete picture of the region. But, you know, you look on the TV every night and you see sort of American tanks rolling through the region and you understand where people's resentment and anger comes from.
What are the biggest mistakes you say that you think the U.S. has made in dealing with the Middle East as a whole is in trying to sort of convert Arabs to Western values? Can you talk about why, how that plays itself out and then why it's so harmful?
Well, I think that in the last administration, you know, there was a sudden emphasis on democracy, that, you know, we have to have democracy and we have to have elections and we're not going to support dictators anymore. I mean, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice gave a very famous speech at the American University in Cairo in June 2005 saying just that. And then she started talking about, you know, the King of Jordan. And, you know, for most Jordanians, they don't think of the King of Jordan as a reformer. They think of Jordan as, you know, a police state just like the rest of the region, you know, maybe not as nasty a police state, but a police state all the same. And I think that those countries have lived under repressive regimes for so long that they just kind of can't make the leap automatically to democracy and to elections. And you kind of need to build out that public space that allows this, you know, elections to be the ultimate goal, not the first goal. So they need freedom of speech, they need freedom of assembly, they need a free press. And I think those are the things that, you know, those building blocks are what outsiders need to encourage. And that will help bring change.
Are people in the Middle East any better at accepting that Westerners have a right to be respected for maintaining their own values?
I think that they sort of, you know, I think that they sense that there's this kind of a double standard, because I don't think that they feel like the Americans or Westerners always extend their values beyond their own borders. And I think maybe like the opposition in Syria is one example, because they feel like they never get their democratic credentials respected. They elected a woman to run the opposition groups, and, you know, the 12 people, including the woman, were all thrown in jail. And nobody speaks out about them because they sort of feel like, well, the only interest in Syria at the moment is to sort of pull them away from the orbit of Iran, so no one's going to talk about domestic politics. And they feel that it's interests rather than values that guides policy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with T.A. in Dallas. Hi, T.A.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, this is T.A. from Dallas, Texas. I just want to thank you for what you're doing. I've been listening to this show for a long time.
Well, thank you.
Number one, I'm going to make it very quick. I am a Muslim, proud to be one. I've been in the States for 18 years. I really want to make one point, that the Muslim world, the Arab world, they got a tremendous respect for America, for the American people. And I know September 11th changed a lot of things. And I, you know what? The people, these few people, they may hate American for no reason, and I don't blame them a whole lot. I blame their government because they do not give them an opportunity to explore and learn what's in the world, what's out there, because if they do, they may turn against them. Where I'm from, we have more than 70,000 Americans. We have American universities. I mean, it's the safest place. There is a lot of safe place for Americans to go. But I think it's shame on the government of a few Muslim countries. I mean, that's who I blame for. But Muslims, Arabs, not all of them, but most of them, they have a lot of respect, even after September 11th. Their dream is to come to the States and live in the States.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about that, Neil?
I mean, I think that's true. I mean, it's sort of, you know, I mean, the joke that we always make among ourselves as correspondents is you find yourself in like a demonstration in Tehran and everyone's screaming, Maghbar America, you know, death to America. And then you go down to interview someone and they say, oh, you're American? How do I get a visa? and I think that, you know, on an individual level, they certainly know and still see this country as a place of opportunity. You know, as a policy, on a policy level, they often feel that they're treated unfairly and they're not listened to, sort of, you know, as America as a whole.
On a sort of light note, you found that the one thing you couldn't bear giving up when you were living overseas was Thanksgiving dinner. Can you talk about what it takes to serve up a traditional turkey dinner when you're living in Cairo?
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about policy things, and I really should emphasize that the book is not a policy tome at all. It really kind of tries to just, you know, eliminate the people that I met and the stories that I wanted to write while I was there. And it's kind of a light way to get into the Middle East. But Thanksgiving was a typical one because I can give up any vacation. I've given up most of them. But Thanksgiving, just because I love the menu and the food, I hate to give it up. So I always try and do it every year. And actually, the one that I remember the most was in Jerusalem, the year of the peace treaty. And I decided that, you know, in the spirit of the holiday, I would invite a couple of Israelis over, a couple of Palestinians, a few other Arab friends, and some British friends. And so I had a big gang coming to my house, and I went to put the turkey in, and the oven door came off in my hand. And it was a Saturday, and neither the Arab nor the Jewish repairmen work on Saturday. It's the Sabbath for both of them, so I didn't know what to do. So I called my mother, and she said, oh, just put up the temperature to 700 and put the turkey in anyway. I did that once. And I said, did it work? She said, no, it was burned on the outside and raw in the middle. So instead, I just called up my friends, and, you know, Arabs and Jews live on the different sides of town in Jerusalem. And I said, listen, if we want to eat, I got to have your ovens. And nobody had an oven big enough. So I put put the turkey in the neighbor's oven, and I put the pies and other stuff, sweet stuff, in a second oven, and then the potatoes and everything in a third. And I just kind of took a taxi around all afternoon, and I'd baste the turkey, and I'd jump in, and I just burned one dish. So I thought I did a pretty good job. And I think it came out a little better than that peace treaty did, because it didn't last so long, the peace treaty.
Well, it is a nice metaphor, I think, for making things work, even when you don't have all the elements in place.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of funny also. I mean, just another aspect of American culture. You know, you were talking about that chef earlier, and people have seen so many Thanksgiving dinners on sitcoms because they watch American sitcoms on TV that I ran into, you know, families that were dying to know how you make a turkey because they wanted to do it instead of a leg of lamb for their Ramadan feast when they break their fast at the end of the day during their holy month of Ramadan. And so Chef Ramsey, the Lebanese chef that I write about, did a program on how to bake a turkey, and a lot of families said, you know, now we eat turkey at Ramadan and we love it.
Well, really interesting stuff, Neil. Neil McFarquhar is former Cairo bureau chief, now the UN bureau chief for the New York Times. His new book is called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Neil, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you who have called throughout the hour to support KERA financially. Your money is what makes it possible for us to make public radio available in North Texas. It's very, very simple. Whether your contribution is $5,000 or $5 or $10 a month, it matters to us. It all adds up. We put it all into an account and draw on it for the year and make sure that public radio is strong in your community. You can help right now by calling 1-800-456-5372. Or going online to the support page at kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And don't forget, when you call 800-456-5372, when you go online to kera.org, you'll be entered to win a trip to London to tour the BBC studios. you and a friend or your spouse or your partner or your nemesis that you want to bury the hatchet with.
Some perhaps. Lucky person that you yes. choose, however you decide.
You and a friend will go to London. You'll fly round trip nonstop on British Airways. This is business class, by the way. And you'll also get a $1,000 Marriott gift card to help pay for your stay while you're in London. And you'll get a tour of the BBC studios right there in London. What an awesome chance for you to see some really awesome behind-the-scenes stuff at the BBC. So somebody's going to win this, Chris, and it could be you if you call.
It's funny to me, Jeff, how excited all of us who work here and who have been talking about this are about business class. It strikes me that for you it may not be such a foreign and bizarre and fantastical concept to fly not coach class anywhere. But regardless of that, it sounds like a terrific trip, and we're excited for whoever's going to win it. And you will be among those in the drawing pool if you make a contribution now at 1-800-456-5372 or at kera.org. I want to thank Dr. Danielle Bew in Grand Prairie, Richard Eng in Burleson, Richard Gilligan in Dallas, and all the rest of you who have been calling throughout the hour.
If you would like a copy of Neil McFarquhar's book, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, you can pick that up when you call 800-456-5372 and join at the $120 membership level. It's a thank you gift. That's the level that it's at. This book is $26.95 retail. So you could, if you choose, give KERA $93.05. And you can go get your own copy of the book at the bookstore or online as you see fit. But please give KERA something. You get so much from this station every single day. We all listen who work here as well, and we, you know, really appreciate your support. But right now it's so crucial that we hear from you either via the web at kera.org or at 800-456-5372. It's so crucial because we'd like to wrap this drive up today. And when we do wrap this drive up, if we do wrap this drive up today, if you join today, we will receive an additional $5,000 donation from Diane Wanger, who is a Tarrant County family attorney, and she's also a supporter of KERA, and she said, if you finish the drive today, I'll give you $5,000 extra dollars to use to offset the cost at KERA. It's called a challenge grant, and we've got to finish for it to happen.
We talk about this a lot. You know, if you love public radio and you listen all the time but you never have made a contribution, please consider the fact that we wouldn't be here if everybody else was like you. If everybody made the decision to listen but not contribute, we couldn't exist. More than half of our money comes from people who listen to the station. And if you think, well, all those people have already done their thing, I would argue that by the time we get to the last day of the membership drive, all the other people who always support the station have already done so. We are counting on you now to help us to get the last something like $70,000+ that we need to raise to be finished. And it can't happen without your support.
Yeah, the last update we got, Chris, I think was around $73,000 left to go. I'm sure that they're tallying furiously so they can give us an update, so we can give you an update. But in the meantime, I want to say thanks to Richard Marshall in Arlington, Phyllis Guest in Dallas, Kathleen Savage in Plano, and Arvin Kreitman in Dallas. Thanks so much for doing your part. All those folks called 800-456-5372 or joined online at kera.org. You can do your part, too. We still have lines available. We still have web bandwidth available to receive your contribution.
You will be supporting your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1 Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, K261 CW 100.1 in Tyler, K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman.
No matter where you listen, though, you know it's KERA. You know it's your public radio station. It's worth your support. It's worth your time. You spend time listening to the station. So we're just asking you to do your part. Help us raise the final $72,500 left to go. $72,500, and the drive is over. Your contribution right now at $50 or $500, you can see how it all starts to add up. So take this opportunity right now, folks, and please call us 800-456-5372. 5372. Go online to kera.org and make that contribution.
We talk a lot about momentum and how important it is. All you really need to do is call once. Then you can stop worrying about our momentum because you have done your thing. Your obligation is satisfied once you call and become a supporting member of the station. If you want to do this by paying for your membership with a credit or debit card, great. We love that because we get the money automatically and we can start putting it to work right away. If you want to become a sustaining member, that's great for us too, because then we know that for the next, you know, the foreseeable future, every month we will have a certain amount of support from you, and that helps us to plan our budget and to keep the station strong and healthy and to continue serving the entire community and most specifically serving you with great quality journalism and radio programming. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. It's quick and easy to call. It takes about 2 minutes. The online experience is about the same unless you spend a long time browsing the thank you gifts. We would love to hear from you, though. 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.